Wednesday Night Rugby
on Off the Ball
with Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us. Everyone in.
Now, you're very welcome along. It is Wednesday Night Rugby. We are joined by Rory O'Connor of the Irish Independent. It has been a couple of weeks. Rory, how you doing?
Not too bad, Joe. Can't complain, you?
Similarly, can't complain. Count the blessings, all that kind of thing. There's a few things we want to talk to you about. We've been doing lots of nostalgia and lots of features over the last couple of weeks on this slot, but there is news absolutely to be discussed. Yeah. I want to get your thoughts on the machinations behind the scenes at World Rugby. Also, just the Irish landscape with a view to when we actually see rugby again and the financial hit that Irish rugby is taking. But we should start clearly with the James Cronin situation. He has been banned for 1 month for doping, in effect, albeit the EPCR have accepted it was unintentional. James Cronin, just jog everyone's memories. I mean, this is an Irish international we're talking about.
Yeah. 124 appearances for Munster. Loose head prop, you know, not the most high profile figure. Largely in that career has been Dave Kilcoyne's kind of backup man, comes on after 50, 60 minutes. But he has gone on there in 3 caps for Ireland. He made his debut all off the bench against Argentina and took him on the Joe Schmidt's first tour in 2014. Was back in the Six Nations against Italy a year later off the bench in Rome. And then a year later again in the Stade de France and I think a defeat to France in 2016. So he's been a fairly, you know, he's been a bit of a Munster stalwart. I think injury has held him back a little bit over the years. He's 29 now, under contract till the end of next season. But he's been a fairly, you know, when he's fit, he's pretty much ever present on that Munster bench. Starts a couple of games as well. A very able deputy for Dave Kilcoyne. And then, you know, we'll be seen as a decent operator, good scrummager, good around the park, fairly aggressive figure on the pitch. So, he's not the most high-profile guy. I don't think I've ever actually got to interview him over the years. But, you know, when he eventually retires, he'll do so with about 150 Munster appearances, which, if not more, which is a pretty good achievement.
Who have we heard from thus far, and how did this story bubble up and then it seems try and bubble away again just as quickly? It was Monday.
Yeah, it's a really, they did a really good job of keeping this under wraps, it has to be said. I mean, James Cronin tested positive after a game against Racing back in November, on November 23rd, and the procedures have all been going on pretty much behind the scenes. He was alerted, I presume, a couple of days later by EPCR. His hearing was held on March 11th, I believe, and obviously, on Monday, EPCR, in conjunction with the RFU and Munster, issued they weren't joint statements, but, you know, a coordinated 3 statements came out in a matter of a few minutes to confirm the news. So, I suppose that means you're bombarded with an awful lot of information all at once. You know, EPCR's release was reasonably detailed, and then it came with a link at the bottom to go into the report itself. He tested positive for a powerful anti-inflammatory drug, prednisolone, he did not have a TUE for, but as I think people probably have heard over the last couple of days, it was down to a pharmaceutical error. He was given the wrong prescription when he went in to pick up antibiotics that were prescribed by the Munster rugby doctor, which, you know, it's an extraordinary turn of events. He's both lucky and unlucky in some ways. I mean, he's very unlucky that now when you Google that drug and even his name, this is going to be beside his name forever. But I guess he's lucky that nothing more serious happened and he wasn't given anything more serious at the time, because, you know, this, you know, he took it, he played, he was fine. He was subjected to a random doping test after the game and was popped.
The RFU, what has their stance been on the whole situation?
They've conducted an investigation in parallel, which they see as kind of an employee-employer kind of job, I suppose, and they have come to the conclusion that EPCR's processes were good and they are happy with the results of it. The RFU have a zero tolerance approach to anti-doping, but I think the finding that this was effectively an accidental, you know, that the burden of responsibility lies more with the pharmacy than with the player, they're happy to go along with that and accept that, you know, James Cronin is receiving a 1 month ban. He won't miss any rugby during that month. You know, just happens to have happened during this lockdown, and it won't be backdated or postponed until then. And they're satisfied at the procedures, that it's an adequate punishment. And as far as we're aware, there is no, you know, financial implication on him. Apart from he's paid his own, he and Munster cover their own costs. Mm. But as far as I know, there's no fine or anything like that. Certainly that hasn't been disclosed publicly. The RFU will be quite private about their employment stuff. I mean, quite private around a lot of stuff. So, but they say they've done an investigation, and that's what's come out of it.
And are they going to publish a report or their investigation?
Yeah. No, as far as I'm aware, that report will stay internal.
Okay. So the Anthony Davies report then, he's a legal member of the EPCR. This was published on Monday. This really gave the most depth and the most information of any of the statements. This was the Racing Munster game, as you said, November 2019. James Cronin came on as a substitute. He was tested randomly afterwards. The sample went to Cologne. In the lab in Cologne, they found prednisolone and prednisone. And he had no TUE for those banned substances. And so there was a case to answer. And I'm basically relaying all this as the report relays it. I'm giving you the abridged notes of the report. So it seems that James Cronin admitted he had taken prednisolone and prednisone in the form of prednisol. That's what he got from the pharmacy. He said he had done so unintentionally. And then the report outlines James Cronin's version of events. And his version of events goes as follows. He was feeling unwell. He went to the Munster team doctor. The Munster team doctor examined him, presumably, I'm presuming that, but examined him presumably, and then emailed a prescription for an antibiotic, amoxicillin, to the pharmacy. And Cronin, it says in the EPCR investigation, had been given this previously, the amoxicillin. So he, the doctor, that is, told Cronin that he had prescribed him antibiotics. That was the phrase he used. I prescribed you antibiotics. He didn't say it was amoxicillin, but he said, I prescribed you antibiotics. 22nd of November, James Cronin goes to the pharmacy. He's given two medications. He goes up to the counter. He's given his bag. Off he goes, gets home. Two medications, amoxicillin, which is what he had been prescribed, and then prednisol. And prednisol has those two substances which are banned, the prednisolone and the prednisone. What happens then is that there are, according to James Cronin's version of events, the only label on the medication is a name. Now, in the report, the other name is redacted, but again, I'm presuming it's either a J. Cronin or a James Cronin. So the only label is a name. There's no date of birth. There's no address. The report says that the amoxicillin and the prednisol had been prescribed to another client. They don't say how they've established that exactly, but that's what they say in this report. Goes on to continue then the situation, pursuant to the dosage instructions. So again, following the dosage instructions, which is an important point, five prednisol tablets were taken that day when he got back from the pharmacy. And then the next morning, the morning of the game, four prednisol tablets were taken. Test happens. He's positive. Case to answer. He waived analysis of the B sample, James Cronin, we should say. So he admitted taking the prednisol. There's no need for a B sample. I did take it, although unintentionally. The evidence provided to back up this version of events is substantial, you would have to say. So, number one, a statement from the Munster team doctor to back up this version of events, that this is what happened. They also provided a copy of the team doctor's prescription, which was just amoxicillin and not prednisol. They then sent on an email, the same email which was sent to the pharmacy. So James Cronin didn't get the prescription in his hand from the doctor. The doctor emailed it to the pharmacy. Yeah. James Cronin went to the pharmacy and said, "Hi, I'm James Cronin. Have you got my medication?" That is the version of events here. They also have provided a pharmacy statement which confirms the error, according to the EPCR. So a pharmacy statement confirming that this is what happened. They also have a copy of the pharmacy's medication dispensing form showing, they say in the report, the wrong medication given to James Cronin. So the dispensing form shows that James Cronin was given the wrong medication. Also provided photos of product labels, packaging, leaflets, all of the bits and bobs around the medication that he was given. Seventh, video footage of James Cronin in the pharmacy as he described it. And then finally, the report also mentions that the Cologne lab have looked at what was in his system and they have concluded that this is all scientifically plausible, that what was in his system is consistent with his version of events and consistent with what he said he took and when he had taken it. We'll pause it there for a second because we'll get into the ban and the length of the ban and how the EPCR arrived at that length of ban. But in terms of a version of events, that is a pretty fair summary of the account of James Cronin as given to us by the EPCR report.
Yeah, that's very comprehensive. I mean, it's and I think the burden of evidence that he's provided or the amount of evidence he's provided certainly worked in his favour when it comes to what Anthony M. Davies decided later on, and you know, when he was coming to his conclusions, because he did find that because of the amount of evidence that had been provided, that while James Cronin did have a responsibility to check and to Google and to, you know, wonder why he got two instead of one, and had basically gone home, followed the instructions on the label, and gone ahead. But the, I mean, it does seem like Cronin, Munster, and his lawyers did a very good job in finding a good trail of evidence to back up his story.
Mm. Then we're on to the part of the report where they explain the ban and the length of the ban. In short, if you dope intentionally, then 4 years is your starting point. You're getting a 4 year ban, and you're working your way backwards for mitigating circumstances, whatever they might be. But it's a 4 year ban. If you have broken the rules unintentionally, which is the case in Cronin's instance, then it's a 2 year ban. 2 years what you're working back from, and then it's mitigating circumstances. So obviously he's got a month. So that's a long way short of 2 years, which is the starting point. In his favor, Anthony Davies says he consulted his doctor. So that's a reliable professional he's consulted. Secondly, he got the medication from a reliable source, the pharmacy, and a source he'd been to previously. And then thirdly, they say the labels on the packaging contained, and again, that part is redacted, but I'm presuming that is a name very similar to Jay Cronin or James Cronin.
Yeah.
So they conclude he thought it was for him. Now, some points you referenced going against James Cronin here, because the technical terms here that the EPCR can arrive at are no fault, as in you have no fault whatsoever, or no significant fault. Now, James Cronin doesn't get no fault. He gets no significant fault. The reason he gets no significant fault as opposed to no fault is, and they listed out, he didn't ask his doctor, what antibiotics are you giving me? So his doctor said, I'm going to give you antibiotics. James Cronin never said, according to this report, what are you giving me? What is it? What's the name? So he didn't know what he was being given. Secondly, he never asked for a copy of the prescription. Just it was emailed to the pharmacy on his behalf. He turned up at the pharmacy. He never had that prescription in his hand. Thirdly, and this is a very interesting point, he had been given this treatment before, the amoxicillin before. However, this is the first time when he's gone to be treated for this ailment that he was given two medications instead of one. And the point Anthony Davies makes is he should have stopped and thought, well, why is that? Why am I getting two here instead of my usual one? Fourthly, the report says the player had never taken prednisol before. Now, I don't know how they've established that. That, you know, we're trying to chase up with different people involved in the report and check that. But they do say the player had never taken prednisol before, so we'll assume that they verified that. Their point, however, is a wider one. They say he had never taken prednisol before and he didn't carry out any research. As you said, he didn't Google it. If he had Googled it, it would have shown up very clearly it's a banned substance. Fifthly, they say the leaflet with the medication does say that this is a steroid medicine. This is a steroid medicine. Again, they feel that should have given a player, a professional athlete, pause for thought.
Yeah.
Therefore, in accordance with strict liability, which is what this whole thing is based on, i.e. an athlete ultimately is responsible for what he or she puts in their system, strict liability, the conclusion is we can't say that James Cronin here has a finding of no fault or negligence. There is no significant fault, which is slightly different. To sum up then, the summary expresses some sympathy for the player. Hmm. Davies says, I am of the view that the player's level of fault was low, talks about like very specific and unusual circumstances, incredibly unusual circumstances. And the conclusion is, if you take the story and the evidence in totality, then the feeling is that a 1 month ban suffices, working back from 2 years. So that's how, you know, people are saying, well, how have they arrived at 1 month? That's how they've arrived at 1 month in the report, basically.
Yeah, and I think that's where people probably are certainly people from other sports are rubbing their heads a little bit and wondering how 1 month at a time when there's absolutely no rugby is an adequate punishment, where, as we've all seen examples in other sports of people who have, you know, I don't know if they have the same level of detail in terms of their mitigation, but they've found some level of mitigation, but they've still been hit with 6 month or year long bans. I think you referenced a few of them on the show this week.
Sorry to interrupt, there was a skier who missed the Winter Olympics. She had, according to her version of events, she's a skier, she was sunburned, she had blisters on her lip, she took medication, She was given 13 months down from the 2 years. She thought that was incredibly harsh. She appealed it. She thought 13 months was too harsh, and they gave her 18 months subsequently. Now, one of the points they made was that it said in very clear labeling that the product went against anti-doping rules. So they said, well, look, you know, you can blame your doctor, but only to a point. So, but regardless, she got 18 months for something which, you know, on the face of it might appear relatively innocuous. I'm not an expert. I don't know exactly what she took. But in comparison with 1 month at a time when there's no rugby, as you said, James Cronin in many respects appears, according to this report, to be very unlucky. But equally, his ban could have been worse.
I think so. And although Anthony Davies is very sympathetic towards Cronin, he does say that he actually says, I have some sympathy for the player in this case. While the violation could have been avoided had the player and his team doctor put better safeguards in place. And I mean, these players, I believe and I understand, have levels of education about this throughout their career. They know when they're in the academy that, you know, if they're taking medication, they need to be checking it. I believe there's an Irish Sports Council app or a WADA app that you put in the name of your medication that's freely available to all of them. And, you know, these are, it's an educated workforce, the Irish Rugby, Irish Rugby professionals. It's one of the most educated workforce in professional sports. So these are not, you know, that there is an onus on players to have some level of responsibility of what they're putting into their body. And I think we can all be guilty of trusting doctors and pharmacists and sometimes being unquestioning to them. Mm. But I mean, it's your career, it's your body, you've got to know what's going into it. So it's up now to WADA. I suppose, you know, I'm just a layman. WADA now have this report. They will look at it. So will the Irish Sports Council and so will World Rugby. They have, I think, I'm not sure, they have a period, I think, of 1 month to review it to see if they agree with the findings of EPCR and whether they want to appeal. Both James Cronin and EPCR have waived the right to appeal. They've come to an agreement there. So the ball, if this is to go any further, you know, if there is any kind of qualms about that 1 month and whether it's consistent with what happens in other sports, which I think has driven some of the outcry online, the length of the ban, that will be decided by WADA, the Irish Sports Council, or World Rugby, who now have a decision to make as to whether they pursue this to CAS.
Mm, okay. So they would pursue it on the basis of potentially the length of ban not being sufficient if they were to pursue it.
Yeah, I mean, I presume they go through the report line by line and see if they're happy that everything was followed through to the letter of the law. I guess this is rugby investigating rugby. So, you know, a neutral body may look at it and compare it with other sports and find that it's better. They might find that it's worse. That's their prerogative now. So, you know, I haven't been in touch with WADA this week and my colleagues were in touch with our sports council. That's kind of their review. You know, it's a very neutral response coming from them. We'll review this. We'll look at it. There's no guidance either way as to whether they'll pursue it anymore or whether this is the end of the matter.
Yeah. Well, as I understand it, Anthony Davies is an independent judicial member affiliated with EPCR, just to be clear on that point. So there are a few elements out of all this. Certainly, like you've referenced there, players taking things without questioning enough is an issue. There is what this means for rugby. It is under the spotlight, certainly more than lots of other sports. Increasingly, people are very aware of the issue of anti-doping across sport, and it's cropped up in rugby, absolutely. So again, this has come to Irish rugby's door. And now I would put it to you that it was all very professionally done on Monday, and there was a statement from James Cronin, statement from Munster, IRFU, we're happy, everyone's happy, and almost a bit of a ribbon put in the thing. We've invited James Cronin onto the show to discuss the issue. He's through Munster, declined that opportunity for the foreseeable future, certainly.
I've been interview requesting for James as well. I haven't heard back from Munster. I'm kind of expecting a similar response. But, you know, how did it affect him? Did he feel better? Did he feel worse? I mean, if he was going into the game with a cold, the reason this is a banned substance is that, it, as well as being an anti-inflammatory and a painkiller, is it does, you know, it's been found, particularly in cycling, to boost your short-term performance. So that's why it is on the banned substance list. So I'd like to know how it made him feel. You're right. I mean, this particular incident is just a very unusual case, a very interesting case, and the detail that you've outlined is fascinating. And especially in a time when there's no sport, it's probably going to draw a bit more attention than maybe it would if this was a big, I don't even know what should have been happening this week, but it might have been an EPCR week or whatever. But, you know, there is a fundamental, I'm sure you get this as well, Joe, when you're in a pub or someone, you know, recognises you or you tell them what they do at a wedding or something. I mean, it doesn't take long in a lot of cases where someone asks you about doping in rugby. I mean, I think there's a conversation that's being had outside of the official airwaves about this, that people do have suspicions about the game. I think, you know, the response of the South Africans when Owen Sheehan asked the questions at the World Cup, the kind of history of doping in that country, particularly at underage level, the fact that they are now world champions, the most powerful team in the world, I think has shone a light on it. A lot has been written about that. The Grobler case a couple of years ago didn't do anyone any favours within Irish rugby, I don't think. You know, Irish rugby has a zero tolerance, you know, its policy is a zero tolerance approach to anti-doping, but I think they fell well short of that in that time. So I do think that it's something that rugby needs to get a handle on and needs to get out in front of. And you know, this case has shone a light on it. I'm not using it as an example. I think it's an example to players of how careful they have to be when they're, you know, around all of this. But I think the fact that it's now out there that one of the players who played for Ireland in the last couple of years now has this asterisk beside his name. You know, if you Google his name from now on, this is, you know, Google his name earlier, like, you know, reports across the world about this, you know, it's going to be a blotter in his copybook for the time being, which, you know, for something that was an inadvertent mistake is unfortunate.
Yeah,
I do think rugby needs to get a handle on this. They need to get out in front of it a lot more. There's obviously a responsibility on players to know what they're putting into their bodies, to question their medics, to Google everything, to ask every question. I think James Cronin is committed to doing education around that. I think he's, you know, now I think that stuff is already happening, but maybe if a group of young players see this fella up in front of them and he goes through his experience, maybe that gets through. I think it would help if he did go public and, you know, chat to people about it, and, you know, young people playing rugby who might not be in academies, who might be, you know, having a look at what's online out there. You know, we do have a steroid culture in our teenage population anyway, away from sport and away from rugby. So yeah, I think you're right. I think rugby, there's a perception battle as well that's going on, and I think rugby is quite keen not to get involved in that discussion, but I do think that there's a chance there to be have more of a leadership role and get out in front of this a bit more, and maybe putting James Cronin up for interview or putting senior figures up this week and saying, this is what went wrong, this is the you know, these are the measures that we're going to put in place to make sure that this can never happen again. That's the next step, I suppose, and you know, during this whole crisis, Irish rugby has pretty much gone to ground, so it's been very hard to get anyone to talk about anything about, you know, about fixtures and all that other stuff, the financial implication.
Yeah,
this is a chance for them to kind of get out in front of this and really take a hold of it, and you know, the more you leave a vacuum, the more people are having discussions about it, the more you lose control of it, I guess.
Yes, no, I would tend to agree. So on the face of it, James Cronin here is incredibly unlucky. This is an extraordinary set of circumstances and events to have happened. And even in the report, Anthony Davis says these are unusual circumstances, specific and unusual. And certainly Anthony Davis is of the opinion that the evidence presented is of hugely mitigating value, because the ban is only 1 month. So therefore, tied into your point, I think transparency here, and as much transparency on behalf of Munster, Cronin and Irish Rugby would be very helpful to everybody. So the evidence that was presented, why not hold a press conference and say, here's the evidence, here's exhibit A, B, C, D, and E, here you go, every newspaper, you can have it, every media outlet, here's the situation, this is what happened, utterly bizarre. Because at the moment, as you said, just a couple of questions you would still want answered, and some clarity, and just total transparency. Like, the Anthony Davis and the EPCR have accepted this. The RFU have accepted this. So there is also a perception issue. And that's where we are at this at the moment, I would suggest. And because of where rugby is coming from in various quarters, that perception issue is one that it needs to take very seriously. So that's the James Cronin situation as it stands, as of now, on Wednesday, 2 days on from the revelation.
And I think just to add to that, there's probably a legal issue in there as well. There's obviously a reason that EPCR redacted the name of the pharmacy and the other patient. There's probably a privacy issue there.
And I understand if a pharmacy doesn't want to come out and say, oh, we were the ones that did that. I understand that. I have sympathy for that. And equally, I understand if the other redacted name patient doesn't want to come out and bear their medical situation to the nation. Sure. Why should they?
And having contacted a couple of pharmacists in the last couple of days just to see whether this is a common occurrence or not, it's possibly a lesson to all of us to check what we have when we come home from the pharmacy, because apparently, while it is unusual, this does happen.
I'm sure it does. So, look, that's the James Cronin situation, and we'll see where it goes over the next while. In fairness, this has all just happened. It's all been revealed. Maybe they want to take their time and they'll choose the best way to be as transparent as possible, and they deserve a bit of time to do that. So we are just 2 days on, and I accept that as well. Mm. Parking that for a moment, the Irish rugby landscape financially must be suffering hugely. This is not Premier League money. This is healthy, very healthy. You know, the RFU have done a good job. Healthy industry, but equally, it's not, you know, money is not growing in trees, and there's virtually no income on the way in at the moment or for the foreseeable. So what are you hearing? Where are we?
It's not, yeah, it's not good. I mean, the RFU took a preventative measure or a precautionary measure, what was that, 3-4 weeks ago by issuing get James Cronin and all of the other professional rugby players out there and everyone who works within this, the provinces and across the RFU with pay cuts of between 10% to 50% to try and get ahead of this. But I think there is a fear that if this drags beyond September, that while they are temporary pay cuts and the plan is to restore the full pay and repay as well when rugby gets back up and running, if you look at the comments of Professor Sam McConaghy in this morning's Irish Independent, it's quite clear that rugby is going to be one of the last sports to go back, because for all whatever we think about social distancing in the stand and behind closed doors, it's hard to escape. It's hard to do rugby with social distancing, and yeah, it's going to be, you know, it's becoming increasingly clear that this stoppage is going to drag on. And for all that we're kind of working in, kind of when is, you know, what is the plan, the mitigation plan for bringing this back, and whether he can do it in Ireland and whether he can do it in Europe, from a public health point of view, it's not looking good for rugby. And yeah, so Philip Brown's done a couple of interviews with the Irish Times. He said that you know, the cancellation of the Italy game in particular was a massive blow. That cost €3.4 million. Leinster would have gotten about more than half a million from that Saracens quarter final. Put it up, you know, they would have got more out of Leinster Munster at Diviva, which probably would have sold out on the back of a Six Nations. So, you know, that's a more than €1 million hit, as well as their normal RDS income. You know, there's a chance, like, if they have to issue refunds for tickets already sold, if EBCR finally realise they cannot run this tournament, which is a potential thing that could happen, there's obviously refunds that will have to go back to customers, whereas the international game can be postponed until the autumn or beyond. The club game is, you know, like football, has a finite window before next season has to start. So yeah, it's not good financially for the RFU. They're actually in a much stronger position than a number of other unions, which is why they were able to do temporary pay cuts for the duration when they made that decision. But I think the picture was slightly rosier, or certainly the discourse around this was more positive than it is now. I think, you know, from what, you know, with the government's decision, was it yesterday or the day before, to extend the ban on public gatherings of more than 5,000 people into, what was it, September, you know, that's putting an awful lot of pressure on. And for all that we, behind closed doors sounds like a good idea, I think the more people look into it, the more difficult it's going to be. So
yeah,
it's going to be a damaging period.
Because even something like the Ireland-Italy game at home, when that was talked about as happening sometime in the future, I think certainly initially that was talked about in terms of being effectively a full house, and therefore it's a couple of million in the bank. And you know, one of the early arguments we had on the show was, well, when things get back to normal, that we should prioritise those marquee games because they are full houses and therefore they bring in a huge amount of income very quickly. But now, like Ireland-Italy behind closed doors in Dublin, or Ireland going to Paris and the Six Nations, I don't, beyond whatever TV money that suddenly initiates, and I don't even know the nature of the agreement, maybe that TV money is already in the bank account, but it most certainly doesn't bring in a couple of million from ticket sales. So Ireland-Italy happening behind closed doors from an IRFU perspective is not really going to plug any major holes very quickly.
Not really. I mean, if you complete the Six Nations, then the Six Nations can dispense their prize money. Okay. And I know I haven't got the details on this, but I know in other sports, basically broadcasters have not paid for what the games that haven't been shown yet, that basically whatever increments, whatever way this is paid, they basically put it on hold until it's done. So, but you're right, rugby, because international rugby in the Six Nations is still a free to air sport for the time being, the deals are not as substantial as they would be for even the Premiership in England, or the top 14 in France, or the football. So unlike major football clubs competing in the Champions League, who really, you know, the crowds are almost window dressing and part of the product, the crowds at the Aviva are absolutely fundamental to driving the game financially in Ireland. And a large proportion.
80% of revenue, the international game.
Yeah, that's it. And that pays for the sevens program. It pays for the women's team. It pays for the AIL. It pays for all of the salaries of all the, you know, pretty much all the salaries of all the teams. So they're in a very difficult position. And I think one of the big problems they have is that we compete internationally at every level of professionalism. We're part of a five country league, which spans two continents. And five, I think, like, you know, I think each of Wales, Northern Ireland and Scotland have their own public health jurisdictions. So you're, you know, to get that competition back up and running, the Pro 14, you need the permission of all those governments. You know, the EPCR, you're relying on France, and for the Champions Cup, you're relying on France and England to both be in line with Ireland. So one thing that may happen if, say, we get to September and things are looking good, but, you know, international travel is on hold, we may be looking at, say, an elongated interprovincial championship. You know, maybe stage, I don't know, do you play double headers at the Aviva Stadium if you're allowed to have more than 5,000 people at the stadium, and things are looking good from that perspective. That's, you know, Leinster started doing a weekly press conference. We asked Guy Easterby about that last week, and he said they're completely open to that. You know, could you see an expanded AIL? The New Zealanders, because they're so isolated, because they've been able to close their borders and they've got this thing completely under control, look like they're going to have their All Blacks go back and play in the Mitre 10 Cup, which is their provincial championship, which is basically the level below Super Rugby. But because even the fact that we have Northern Ireland as part of this, getting the island on stream is going to be very, very difficult for both the GAA and rugby. So look, there's loads of layers of complications that they're working through. I think there's bi-weekly or at least weekly conference calls, you know, being chaired by World Rugby, involving EPCR, Premiership, Top 14, all the international teams. And there's a definite imperative to get it. Like, it looks like the provinces will not see, unless they get the Champions Cup run off first, which is looking less and less likely. If we get back to rugby and we're allowed travel internationally in September, October, November, we could have something like 8 to 12 weeks of international rugby. We could have a full Six Nations. We could play off the Spring Six Nations and then go into another one. I basically repeated the same thing. You know, the summer tour is definitely going to be cancelled. There's talk that could be replayed in October, November. I think there's a lot of scenarios on the table, but it's looking pretty bleak. And the longer, I think Philip Brown has said that if it goes on beyond September, it's going to have massive ramifications. You know, I don't know, does that mean the pay cuts become more permanent? I mean, South Africa's announced a massive cut to their budget yesterday, somewhere around 50 million euro out of their budget for just the next 8 months to December. Like, this is having a massive impact on the game globally. And while the RFU made a massive profit last year because they sold property around City West or Newlands Cross, which, you know, things look really, really good, like all sporting organisations around the world now, the more this goes on, the more it exposes how reliant they are on fans and sport actually going ahead.
No, it's bleak. It's incredibly bleak. Even in Australia, there's a revolt underway. 11 former captains have signed a letter effectively calling for a complete overhaul at Rugby Australia. They have their own issues besides COVID, obviously, but it's bleak right across the globe when it comes to rugby. And just to finish on the global game, I suppose, Bill Bowman, the incumbent, the chairman at World Rugby versus his one-time vice chairman, Augustin Pichot, in the elections. May 13th, these will happen. Bernard Laporte wants to be Bill Bowman's vice chairman as well. This is being billed, if you look at it casually, as yesteryear, old man Bill Bowman versus the young swashbuckling Pichot who wants to tear everything up and revolutionise the game. How different are their visions for the next 10 years of rugby when you boil it down?
They're not as different as it would seem, but I do think Pichot's appetite for risk will be far greater than Bill Bowman's. And I think you can kind of, like, this has basically been my sport for the last couple of days. I mean, the storylines that have come out of this has been fantastic. We've had, like, not particularly positive ones, you know, the Fijian rep who was going on to the Exco. Fiji had backed Bill Bowman, has been investigated by Amnesty International as a convicted killer who was done for manslaughter in 2007. He's been subsequently removed. That's been damaging to Bowman's cause. It's been seen, it looks like, according to reports in New Zealand overnight, this is going to come down to one vote. But Bowman basically has been backed by the old order, the Six Nations, who really are, like, never more has it been, it's never been more important for the Six Nations to hold on to what they have, because it looks like they're going to use the Six Nations to get themselves out of this by just playing it over and over again, which, you know, whether people's appetites for that is there, I'm not sure, but we'll get to that down the line. So Pichot will be, I think, will be closer aligned to the clubs. He will be closer aligned to Tier 2 nations. I think he's more of a disruptor. He wants to loosen the stranglehold that the so-called Tier 1 countries have on the game, introduce promotion relegation, get a global season, which I think is definitely on the cards, regardless of who wins this, because at the end of the day, World Rugby will ride to the financial rescue of a couple of unions who will need it, and that will soften their position or weaken their position. Beaumont, I think, will win because the Six Nations have such a strong position on the World Rugby Board because of their really archaic voting structures, which, again, Pichot wants to get rid of, but they have a massive block that's very hard to break up. He's also been backed by Bernard Laporte, who, you know, the former France coach, is the head of the French Federation, and he's a real operator. And he, I think, he'll be elected regardless because no one's running against him for vice chairman. So whether he can work with Pichot because he's running against him, I'm not sure. But I mean, he's a very interesting figure in all of this as well. And I think he will bring change because he's a man who has to be respected. His record is excellent and it's fairly formidable as well. So Beaumont is very, I mean, Bill Beaumont to me is a question of sport. You know, he's kind of an establishment figure. He's been around for an awful long time. He's been on the board of World Rugby since the 90s, since the early 90s, as far as I can remember. Whereas Pichot is from the professional era. He's from what was a Tier 2 country who fought their way tooth and nail to get to Tier 1, who put themselves in the top table, often at Ireland's expense. He's not popular. I don't know if the RFU would see him as a force for good. He's crossed swords with them many, many times on and off the pitch. I don't think he'd be viewed too positively on Lansdowne Road. But I think if you're going to grow the game, if you're going to take rugby into this century, and like he's even talking about, one of the things he's talking about as a modernizer is to try and get a marquee video game for rugby, like a Madden or a FIFA. And some people will scoff at that. But I do think when you're trying to build a brand, you're trying to, you know, appeal to a new audience. I think esports is one of the things that's doing well out of this. There is, you know, he's at least thinking that way. He's at least thinking more modern.
Yeah.
And whereas Beaumont,
talking about bringing the Lions to America even this morning.
Yeah, like, you know, there is innovation in what he says. Whether when he gets in, he'll be able to carry it out. Whether he'll be able to break down the silos that are there or the kind of old order, it's hard to know. And whether he's as revolutionary as he says he is,
yeah,
none of us can say, but he certainly promises a lot, and I'd love to see, you know, I'd love to see what he would do if he got in there. We've had Beaumont for 4 years, so it's a bit like, you know, a politician going for re-election. They can promise everything, but the opposition can always say, "Well, why didn't you do that before?" Beaumont's coming in, having not achieved a lot of the things that he wanted to achieve, you know, particularly the Nations Championship. Pichot was alongside him, but Pichot can at least say, you know, I wasn't the power broker, he was. So
yeah.
I think the votes go in on Sunday, and then it's announced, on, as you said, in May. It's going to be very close. I think the old order will hang on, particularly because of financial issue. But I think because Pichot has been such a strong challenger, Beaumont might be forced into making some changes. And I think because of COVID and the shutdown and the financial issues that we've talked about across the game, I think we're in for a big change in the next 6 to 8 months anyway. I think Pichot would probably drive greater change than Beaumont, but I think, you know, there's a chance here for World Rugby to finally get some traction on some of their plans, particularly trying to align the seasons and maybe get a, you know, one season in a calendar year across both hemispheres, which I think has been waiting to happen for an awful long time.
Okay, very good. Rory O'Connor of the Irish Independent, keep up the good work. Thanks a million.
Thanks, Joe. Good to see you.
Wednesday Night Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us, everyone in.